Chapter 12, Medicine, by Linda Villarosa. In 2002, when Dr. Susan Moore received her degree from the University of Michigan Medical School, she joined a small sorority of black women with the MD credential after their names. That year, fewer than 700 black women graduated from American medical schools out of a total of nearly 16,000 newly minted doctors. Several years later, Moore settled in the Indianapolis area, where she practiced family and geriatric medicine, raised her son Henry, and cared for her parents. But in 2020, when the COVID-19 pandemic hit, years of medical training and the credentials she'd worked so hard to earn would fail to protect her from the healthcare system itself. On November 29th, Moore tested positive for COVID-19, and soon after, she checked in to Indiana University Health North Hospital in Carmel, a suburban city near Indianapolis. On December 4th, she posted a video on her Facebook page that showed her lying in her hospital bed, a breathing tube inserted in her nose. Her voice halting as she struggled to catch her breath, Moore detailed disrespectful treatment by a white physician, whose name she took the time to spell out. He had rejected her plea for additional doses of an antiviral medication used to treat COVID, she said, adding in the post accompanying the video, "He did not even listen to my lungs. He did not touch me in any way." And despite what she described as excruciating neck pain, according to her account, he told her he was uncomfortable giving her additional pain medication and tried to send her home. "I was crushed," a tearful Moore said in the video recorded on her cell phone, her eyes wide with a combination of frustration and fear. "He made me feel like I was a drug addict, and he knew I was a physician. I don't take narcotics. I was hurting." Then, looking directly into the camera, her voice shaking with rage, Moore offered this scathing indictment of the American medical system, which had betrayed her. "I put forth, and I maintain, if I was white, I wouldn't have to go through that. This is how black people get killed." Moore died 2 weeks later at age 52. In her assessment of the U.S. healthcare system, she was correct on two counts. First, as a black American, she was more likely to contract COVID-19 than a white American. And second, she was more likely to die from the disease. Around the time of her death, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention released data showing that black Americans were 1.4 times more likely than white ones to contract the virus, 3.2 times more likely to be hospitalized, and 2.8 times more likely to die. Black Americans disproportionately contracted COVID-19 because of the many ways America's history of racial violence and inequality is baked into the institutions and structures of our society. Black Americans are more likely to work in low-wage jobs and to live in segregated, crowded, polluted neighborhoods that lack adequate healthcare facilities and transportation. They are far less likely than white Americans to live near safe outdoor spaces and have access to healthful and affordable food. These factors, the social determinants of health, have long had an outsized influence on health outcomes, and they help explain the racial disparities that were an immediate feature of the pandemic in the United States. The environment itself has been shown to worsen COVID-19 outcomes for Black Americans. In April 2020, as the pandemic surged, researchers from the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health conducted a study that linked long-term exposure to dirty air to higher risk of death from the virus. This dangerous connection between air pollution and respiratory illness was not lost on those scientists and policymakers who have long known that African Americans shoulder a disproportionate burden of exposure to the nation's polluted environments. These social determinants more commonly impact poor communities, but racial health inequality transcends class, and even well-educated black people with access to health care, like Susan Moore, are more vulnerable to a number of serious diseases. For one, they are affected by the stress of coping with racism embedded in day-to-day life, which can lead to a kind of premature aging. Arlene T. Geronimus, a professor at the University of Michigan School of Public Health, does research in this area. She coined the term weathering to explain how high-effort coping in the face of continuous racial insults exacts a physical price on the bodies of Black Americans. What's more, as revealed by Dr. Moore's tragic death, even when Black people go to a medical facility for treatment and care, they can still be subject to racism's dehumanizing effects. The medical establishment has a long history of mistreating Black patients, either by failing to take their suffering seriously or by dismissing their concerns. This often comes up in the context of pain management. The physician who ignored Dr. Moore's distress and denied her pain relief was more than an isolated bad apple. The problem of minimizing Black pain has been well documented in scientific literature. A 2013 review of studies examining racial disparities in pain management, published in the American Medical Association Journal of Ethics, found that Black and Hispanic people, from children with adenoidectomies and tonsillectomies to elders in hospice care, received inadequate treatment for pain, especially as compared with their white counterparts. Why would this be the case? For centuries, white physicians and scientists went to great lengths to prove that Black bodies were biologically and physiologically different from white bodies. To be clear, different almost always meant inferior. These physicians and scientists used their expertise and even empirical data to insist that enslaved Africans were fit for slavery and that the institution was not immoral or cruel, as many proclaimed. Over time, their theories became incorporated into and normalized in medical practice. And this racializing of medicine did not end after slavery. Two persistent physiological falsehoods, that Black people were impervious to pain and that they had weak lungs that could be strengthened through hard work, have wormed their way into the scientific consensus and can still be seen in modern-day medical education and practice. A study of 222 white medical students and residents, published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in 2016, showed that half of the students and residents endorsed at least one false idea about biological differences between Black people and white people, including that Black people's nerve endings are less sensitive than those of white people. When asked to imagine how much pain white or Black patients experienced in hypothetical situations, the medical students and residents who held more false beliefs were more likely to maintain that Black people felt less pain, and thus they were less likely to recommend appropriate treatment. This is how Black people get killed. The COVID-19 pandemic has made it clear that by several measures, the health status of Black Americans is on par with that of people living in far poorer nations, and that at every stage of life, Black Americans have poorer health outcomes than white Americans, and even in most cases, than other ethnic groups. Racial health disparities show up at the beginning of life and cut lives short at the end. Black babies are more than twice as likely as white babies to die at birth or in the first year of life, a racial gap that adds up to thousands of lost lives every year. African American adults of all ages have elevated rates of conditions such as diabetes and hypertension that among white people are found more commonly at older ages. In the first half of 2020, owing to the pandemic, the Black-white gap in life expectancy increased to 6 years, from 4 in 2019. This inequality, when it comes to the health of Black people's bodies, is rooted in false ideas about racial differences, developed and spread during slavery, and long challenged by Black medical practitioners and scholars, that still inform the way medical treatment is administered in America. To understand the racial divide in the health of our nation that was stripped bare by COVID-19, we must examine the roots of these myths. In the 1787 manual, A Treatise on Tropical Diseases and on the Climate of the West Indies, A British doctor, Benjamin Moseley, claimed that black people could bear surgical operations much more easily than white people, noting that, quote, what would be the cause of insupportable pain to a white man, a Negro would almost disregard. To drive home his point, in a later edition he added, quote, I have amputated the legs of many Negroes who have held the upper part of the limb themselves. Thomas Jefferson, in Notes on the State of Virginia, published the same year as Moseley's treatise, listed what he proposed were, quote, distinctions which nature has made. They secrete less by the kidneys and more by the glands of the skin, which gives them a very strong and disagreeable odor, he explained, offering no evidence. Jefferson, who both owned and fathered enslaved people, extrapolated that black people were different emotionally and intellectually. They seem to require less sleep, he wrote. A black, after hard labor through the day, will be induced by the slightest amusements to sit up till midnight or later, though knowing he must be out with the first dawn of the morning. In the years that followed, physicians and scientists embraced some of Jefferson's unproven theories, perhaps none more aggressively than Samuel Cartwright, a physician and professor of, quote, diseases of the Negro, at the University of Louisiana in New Orleans, now Tulane University. His widely circulated paper, Report on the Diseases and Physical Peculiarities of the Negro Race, published in the May 1851 issue of the New Orleans Medical and Surgical Journal, catalogued supposed physical differences between white people and black people, including the claim that black people had lower lung capacity, what he called vital capacity. To pursue this theory, he became one of the first doctors in the United States to measure pulmonary function with an instrument called a spirometer. According to his subsequent, quote, calculations, the deficiency in the Negro may be safely estimated at 20%. Cartwright, conveniently, saw forced labor as a way to, quote, vitalize the blood and correct the problem. Most outrageously, Cartwright maintained that enslaved people were prone to a, quote, disease of the mind called drapetomania, which caused them to run away from their enslavers. Willfully ignoring the inhumane conditions that drove desperate men and women to attempt escape, he insisted without irony that enslaved people could contract this ailment when their enslavers treated them as equals, and he prescribed whipping the devil out of them as a preventive measure. These fallacies had dangerous and terrifying outcomes for black people. The false theory of higher black pain tolerance led to the use of black people as subjects in medical experiments that today we would view as unconscionable torture. The work of physician J. Marion Sims, long celebrated as the father of modern gynecology, offers one of the most infamous examples. Between 1845 and 1849, before anesthesia was widely in use, Sims used enslaved women in Montgomery, Alabama, as the subjects of painful operations so that he could perfect a surgical technique to repair vesico-vaginal fistulas, which can be an extreme complication of childbirth. In his autobiography, The Story of My Life, Sims described the agony the women suffered as he cut their genitals again and again. A similar testament of torture, told from the other side of the operating table, is offered in Slave Life in Georgia, a narrative of the life, sufferings, and escape of John Brown, a fugitive slave, now in England, which was published in 1855. Brown, who had been enslaved on a Baldwin County, Georgia plantation in the 1820s and 30s, was lent by his enslaver to a physician named Dr. Thomas Hamilton. This doctor was obsessed with proving the existence of physiological differences between black and white people, and Brown wrote about the excruciatingly painful medical experiments Hamilton put him through, until his body was disfigured by a network of scars. Among Hamilton's concerns was determining the thickness of black skin, which he believed was greater than the thickness of white skin. Brown explains how Hamilton applied blisters to my hands, legs, and feet, which bear the scars to this day. He continued until he drew up the dark skin from between the upper and the under one. He used to blister me at intervals of about 2 weeks. This went on for 9 months, Brown wrote, until the doctor's experiments had so reduced me that I was useless in the field. Hamilton was a courtly Southern gentleman, a wealthy plantation owner, a respected physician, and a trustee of the Medical Academy of Georgia. Like many other Southern doctors of the era, he sought to scientifically prove that black bodies were composed and functioned differently than white bodies. This was in keeping with the prevailing view of Southern white society at the time that enslaved people were fit for little besides forced labor. Hamilton and other doctors bolstered this view, arguing that black people had large sex organs and small skulls, which translated to promiscuity and a lack of intelligence and a higher tolerance for heat. These invented, quote, facts, legitimized in medical journals, justified the barbaric violence of whipping and torture used to maintain slavery. The abuse of black people under the guise of advancing medical discovery would continue even after slavery ended. In the early 1930s, scientists recruited black men to participate in what would become one of the most notorious episodes in American history, the Tuskegee study of untreated syphilis in the Negro male. Between 1932 and 1972, the U.S. Public Health Service conducted a study on more than 600 black Alabama day laborers and sharecroppers, including 399 who had syphilis and were not treated, to examine the progression of the disease. The subjects were told that they would receive treatment for what was described as, quote, bad blood. They never did. Instead, government clinicians, ignoring the pain and suffering these men endured, allowed the illness to advance. Once the men died, doctors autopsied their bodies to compile data on the ravages of the disease. Today, Cartwright's 1851 paper reads like satire, and Hamilton's supposedly scientific experiments appear simply sadistic. In 1997, President Bill Clinton apologized for the Tuskegee syphilis study, calling it shameful and deeply, profoundly, morally wrong. And in 2018, a statue commemorating Sims in New York's Central Park was removed after prolonged protests that included women wearing blood-splattered gowns in memory of Anarka, Betsy, Lucy, and the other enslaved women he brutalized. Yet, fallacies about black immunity to pain, extra thick skin, and weakened lung function that were introduced into the scientific literature by these and other racist doctors continue to show up in medical education today. Even Cartwright's footprint remains. Today, most commercially available spirometers used around the world to diagnose and monitor respiratory illness have a, quote, race correction built into the software to control for the assumption that black people have less lung capacity than white people. In her 2014 book, Breathing Race into the Machine, The Surprising Career of the Spirometer, From Plantation to Genetics, Lundy Brown, a Brown University professor of pathology and laboratory medicine and Africana studies, as well as a professor of medical science at Brown's Warren Alpert Medical School, notes that the race correction is conventional practice, treated as fact in textbooks and still taught in many medical schools. Other unproven theories persist as well. One-third of the medical students surveyed in the 2016 study published by the National Academy of Sciences still believed the lie that Thomas Hamilton tortured John Brown to try to prove, nearly two centuries ago, that black skin is thicker than white skin. Even after many reckonings with its racist past, our medical establishment still has not fully accepted how the distorted beliefs that were born during slavery play a role in creating healthcare inequality today. As a result, scientists, doctors, and other medical providers, and those training to fill such positions in the future, are often unaware of their own complicity in perpetuating the internalized racism and the conscious and unconscious biases that drive them to go against their oath to do no harm. The hospital system in Indiana, where Susan Moore was treated, didn't immediately understand the hurt its staff had caused or the impact of lingering false assumptions about black bodies and black pain on medical decision-making. After she died, Indiana University Health conducted an external review, which concluded that Moore's caregivers had lacked awareness of implicit racial bias. Though the report contended that the medical management and technical care that Moore received did not contribute to her untimely death, it conceded that there was a lack of empathy and compassion shown in the delivery of her care. An earlier statement from the president and CEO of the organization seemed to blame Moore for her own death. He referred to her as a, quote, complex patient, and said that the nursing staff at the facility might have been intimidated by her medical knowledge as she voiced her concerns and critiqued the care they were delivering. This is how Black people get killed. We have long understood the crisis of poor health outcomes for Black Americans as a problem of race, but this implies an inferiority of Black bodies or Black culture. What happened to Dr. Moore speaks to the pervasive, long-running racial bias in the U.S. healthcare system, an erroneous set of deep-seated beliefs formulated during slavery and perpetuated over the decades since by social, political, and economic inequality. In reality, it's never been race that predicts the disease and disability that disproportionately afflict Black Americans, but racism. Until we come to terms with the discrimination and inequality in American medicine, Black people will continue to be harmed by the very system that's supposed to take care of them. That is how Black people get killed.